Hi, this is James Devine, and I am an educator who has come out of the trenches. Listen in as my friend and colleague Dana Goodyear shares stories and tips from other educators who have come out of the trenches.
Welcome to the Out of the Trenches podcast. This is Dana Goodyear. Thanks for listening.
My next guest is Phyllis Daigle. She is a K-8 counselor, therapist, and author of Middle School Matters. She lives in Bethesda, Maryland, with her husband and three children. Phyllis has worked in both public and private schools with students in grades K through 12. She currently works full-time as a school counselor for Sheridan School in Washington, D.C., and provides therapy to children, teens, and adults in private practice at the Chrysalis Group, Inc. Phyllis is the author of Middle School Matters and a journalist. She is a frequent contributor to the Washington Post, focusing on counseling, parenting, and education, and writes a career confidential weekly advice for PDK International for Educators and the Meaningful Middle column for AMLE, which is the Association of Middle Level Educators. She has also written for Psychology Today and numerous other publications. Thank you for being on the podcast, Phyllis.
Thanks for having me.
So in the pre-chat, we talked a lot about being in the trenches. So Phyllis, tell me about your nonlinear path to education.
So I ended up in counseling after thinking I was going to be a lawyer and scrapping that path and then deciding to go to journalism school. And I ended up working in magazine publishing for nearly a decade before I went back to school to get my degree in counseling. And back then I really felt in some ways that I had failed, that it was really important that I stay on the same track consistently throughout my career, and that I was flaky, that I was changing my mind and moving around. And I really just set journalism aside and decided, well, now I'm a counselor. And it took about 10 years until I was able to revisit writing while counseling and realize that it wasn't so black and white, that it was okay to have multiple pursuits and even have multiple pursuits simultaneously. And that was a real lesson for me. I don't think the younger generations struggle with that in nearly the same way that I did as a Gen Xer, but growing up in a household with parents who had the same career their entire life, it really felt like a departure for me to not only switch, but then to somehow combine them again down the road.
And also, you told me a little bit about a story of when you were in the trenches and how you were working with bureaucracy in your career. How did you manage to crawl out of that situation?
So that actually ties into the nonlinear path. I think the reason I started freelancing again is because I had embarked on a really long, arduous, pretty much volunteer pursuit to do some research that I thought would help kids. Mm-hmm. And due to a lot of bureaucratic things that happen in very large school districts, I wasn't able to do that research. I wasn't able to complete the project. And as a result, I was frustrated and decided I was going to need another way to express myself and share the information that I wanted to get out there to not just help the kids in my own school, but to help kids in other schools and to help parents as well. And that's when I started freelancing again. And the research project itself, the details of it are not important, but what is important for me personally, for my own journey, is when I embarked on that research project, and I was probably 40 at the time that I was working on it, I was definitely conflict averse. I'm an introvert and I'm fairly shy to begin with, but I would go out of my way to avoid any kind of conflict with anybody, really, whether they were somebody, I was very deferential to my supervisors, mm-hmm. and very, just went out of my way to make other people comfortable. And this was the first time that I was just so upset that I had done all of this work for nothing that I went to the ombudsman when it was over to really share my concerns that a project that would have been good for students had been terminated for reasons that really didn't make a lot of sense. And that was kind of a turning point for me. And ever since then, I've and this was advice I got from my principal at the time, I really have decided to ask for forgiveness instead of permission if I think I'm on a path that will serve students. And maybe that's just a confidence that comes later in one's career, or maybe it's when you think you've hit bottom and there's nowhere to go but up, that you're willing to take those kinds of risks. But if I were to share a piece of advice with other similarly, I don't want to use the word meek, but similarly conflict averse educators, it would be to not always feel like you have to shy away from conflict, that sometimes it's okay to advocate for your projects or for your kids, particularly if you think it's in their best interest and ethical and safe and good for everyone involved.
No, I think that's great advice to people who are wanting to take risks and thinking of a project or something they'd like to do. But you know, if you can show how it will benefit kids and how it's best for kids, then you have more likelihood to get that off the ground.
Definitely. And it can take some guts to get outside of your lane. And sometimes it ruffles people's feathers, changes the status quo in ways that people aren't familiar with. But despite all of those things that can get in the way, I really don't have any regrets about pushing for something that I believed in at the time. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, while I wasn't able to do the research, I was able to incorporate some of the things that I learned in my book, so it wasn't all for naught. And I definitely learned a lot about myself from that experience.
No, I think that's great to hear about. You know, a lot of time you feel like you're in the trenches, but when you're learning from that experience later, you're looking back and realizing what it taught you. That's the true learning. That's the true reflection that you can talk about now much later as you're reflecting.
Yes, I totally agree with you. And help our students when we let all of that go, when we really are willing to fail and put it all on the line.
Mm-hmm. No, and I think that's great when you're being transparent and, you know, telling how you're able to get through those experiences and not fear failure, right? Because failure is what moves us forward. So what would you say to educators who are currently feeling like they're in the trenches or they're dealing with a conflict, maybe within their district, with a bureaucracy, maybe with a supervisor or a colleague? How would you help them move forward?
You know, I think change is really hard, and it's really hard to take risks, particularly if you have had some setbacks or conflict with people within your organization. And I think it's at those moments when we most need change that we most fear change. I know that for me, when I was looking at taking the position I now have, which is in a K-8 after being in a middle school environment, I was petrified at the prospect of working with young children. That just seemed so scary. Mm-hmm. And I can remember saying to my principal at the time, I'm sure it can't possibly be as scary as I'm imagining it to be. And I would do some self-talk that I was really overinflating the level of risk I was assuming. The irony is actually I was taking on far more risk than I knew. Mm-hmm. When I got to my new school, I ended up teaching mindfulness to kindergartners that first year. I ultimately became a sex education and wellness teacher with middle schoolers, which was totally far afield from what I've been doing in the past. And of course, I ended up writing this book and having to go on the road and speak publicly to people all over the world, which is something that terrifies me to begin with. So the irony is I actually had more to fear, but what I have discovered is that the more you expose yourself to those fears, particularly in small doses, the more capable you are of assuming those risks and of going forward, even though you're terrified. I think sometimes we assume that we can't be brave because we have fear, when often other emotions or other driving forces, it could be clarity of purpose, it could be stubbornness, it could be really anything, can actually propel you over that fear and give you the courage you need in those moments.
Mm-hmm. No, I think those are great words of advice for educators who, you know, are kind of lingering, right? There's a lot of people that linger. They think, well, this isn't the year to do it, or, you know, I might want to pursue another position or, you know, move to a different district, but, you know, they always put it off, right? So I think it's just trying to overcome those fears and making sure that, you know, you're never going to know unless you try, right?
That's right. And you can pick yourself up if it doesn't work out and do something different. I was recently talking to my literary agent who was asking me when I was going to write my next book because the publisher was interested in that. Uh-huh. And I've been putting it off and putting it off. And part of the reason I had been putting it off is because I secretly kind of actually wanted to write a novel next, which is completely in another direction. And I think if there's any theme to my life, it's that I enjoy change more than I think I enjoy change, and I like taking on new challenges. But she said to me, you know, maybe you should write another nonfiction book first. Maybe you should solidify this space that you have been operating and living in for a while, and, you know, continue along the same vein. Mm-hmm. And my instinct was to say, yes, of course I should, because I think we have a lot of shoulds. You know, we should mm-hmm. stay until we have our pension. We should can stay until we've done X amount of years so it doesn't look like we jump around a lot, or we should stay the course, or we shouldn't do, you know, you can come up with a gazillion different reasons why we shouldn't take a chance, or why we shouldn't do something, and why we should get off of that path. And I really had to, even now, even having learned all of the lessons I've learned, had to stop and remind myself, you know, if I wanted to write a novel, there's nothing to say that I can't do that. But mm-hmm. nothing that can happen, except for perhaps it doesn't get off the ground, and that's okay too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and you have that chance already since you have that agent who's asking you about the novel as well. And, you know, you might not have written anything yet, but you have, you know, the door's open, right? So
the door's open. I'm not sure she really would like me to write a novel, but mm-hmm. I joke with her. I want to write a novel about a it's not even a joke. I want to write a novel about a counselor who is enlisted to work for a U.S. intelligence agency, and I think it would be a really fun story, but that's a very DC angle.
Yeah, no, I mean, use your experience and see where that goes. So we talked a lot in the pre-chat about people that maybe have conflict among colleagues or with just the bureaucracy, and that feel they're in the trenches that way. That's often prevalent among educators working in middle schools. Why do you think that's so?
That's a really interesting question, whether or not it's more prevalent in middle schools. You know, I think some of it is just education in general. Mm-hmm. I think in any field, and this is probably true for nonprofits in general, but I think when you're working in industries where you are not rewarded with bonuses, there's not that financial incentive, you're not promoted most of the time, you know, most people are not on a promotion track. I think that people end up trading in things like intangibles, you know, the perception of access to power, the perception of favoritism, the sense that your work is valued or that somebody is coming and watching you in the classroom. I think those things take on a lot more significance in environments where there isn't other forms of extrinsic validation. And for people who struggle with functioning without that extrinsic validation, with, you know, for whom it's not enough just to have your students do well, or to, you know, and some teachers will very openly say, you know, I need more, and I applaud them for that, for letting their supervisors know what they need. But if that is something that you need and you're not getting it, I think it can lead to some bad feelings among colleagues, and it can lead to a sense of competition. One of the things I've written about a lot is how we can raise girls, and I typically write mostly about middle school age, and about how we can raise girls who build one another up rather than tearing one another down. And not to be to hone in on one gender in particular, although education is about 80% female, and I think that I observed it a little bit more there than I have in other environments, perhaps because of the nature of the field and perhaps because it's more female. But there is this sense, and I think society reinforces it a lot, that there's this limited pie and that we have to battle each other out in order to get a slice of that pie. And nothing could be farther from the truth. I tell my kids all of the time, my own kids, my students, the more you support one another, the more you show up for one another, the more you're there to back one another up and root for each other and cheer each other on, the more that boomerangs back to to benefit you. And I don't mean in that self-serving way and that you should do it because it's self-serving, but it leads to feeling good. It leads to expanding the pie. Everybody thrives in an environment that's supportive. And I do think that it's incumbent on schools to really extinguish behaviors that do mimic the worst of what we hear about with middle schoolers. And I love middle schoolers, and I think they're unfairly maligned, and I don't see them as mean or drama seeking. I think they're still building those skills. But when you compare the adults in the, when you think about the adults in that building, it's especially important that they are role models for their students. Mm-hmm. It does all trickle down. I spoke to a principal, this was probably 5 years ago, his name is Craig Vroom, and I only spoke to him one time, but we were talking, I was writing an article at the time about how to cultivate kindness and empathy among students, among middle schoolers, and he started sharing a story about staff, and how when staff are not kind to one another, one of the things he had learned over the years of being a leader was that you have to vote them off the island. And I never forgot that phrasing, because I think there's a belief, particularly in schools, that a lot of people subscribe to, that it's a team structure, mm-hmm. and that you have, which it is, but that you want to really look at it from the vantage point of the building. And, you know, what can we do to support the people in the building? And it can be easy to realize that one person in that building or a couple people in a building can really change the culture for everybody. And I think it's a bit counterintuitive, but I think that if we all look bigger beyond the building itself, but to how we fit into the larger society, kind of like sharing that research with other schools, if we think about what behavior we expect, not just within the building, but just in general, we're more likely to target those behaviors and to address them directly.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's so well pointed out about school culture, because we know, you know, whatever the students see going on amongst adults, you know, they're not blind. They will pick up on that. And if there's conflicts amongst colleagues, there's going to be conflict among the kids as well. So.
Yeah. And I don't think that there's such a thing as a conflict-free workplace, and there's no such thing as a perfect employee, and no conflict is one-sided. So I think it's important that when we have these experiences, when we have conflict, that we take a hard and unflinching look at ourselves and at whatever we've contributed to that situation, and that we learn from it, and ideally, you know, not forget it, but maybe even teach others or share it with others so that we pay that lesson forward. Mm-hmm. You know, we're all learning. I know when I went shortly after, this was also several years ago, but shortly after I left my last job, I was asked to write a workplace advice column for educators. And it was on the heels of that research project and on the heels of some other disappointments in the workplace. And I remember saying to them, I don't think I'm equipped to write this. I don't think I'm the right person, because I've made so many mistakes myself. And the editor at the time said, well, why don't you do a trial? Why don't you do a sample column and let's see how it goes? And she assigned a question that was related to workplace culture in the education workplace. And I answered it. And she came back and she said, you know, we really would like you to write this column. And well, at the time I was so insecure about doing it. What I realize now in retrospect is it's the failures that really teach us the most. It's my experiences, whatever went right, whatever went wrong, I can bring that empathy and those experiences to the column. And I've subsequently learned that there's so much commonality. A lot of the things that people worry are their own shortcomings or their own experiences or their own embarrassment or humiliation are really pretty universal. There's some things that everybody is experiencing across the board, and nothing like getting 1,000 letters from educators, from principals down to teachers, to realize that everybody is learning as they go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we don't know a lot of the time other people's struggles. I was just listening to another podcast this morning about there's a mastermind for teachers, right? And the new teachers a lot of time don't get the support they need. They're on their own island. They usually are assigned a mentor teacher, but they don't sometimes get along with that person, or the person doesn't have time to reach out to them. So there was an organization that has a mastermind for teachers, new teachers, And all those teachers that were submitting comments to the Facebook, to that new teacher group, were all saying the same thing, right? That they were struggling, they were thinking about leaving their profession. But that's why it's so great to have networks of colleagues, such as a mastermind or type of, you know, maybe outside of the district network, where you're able to talk to like-minded colleagues or people in similar positions, because people are all dealing with the same type of struggles, right?
And students too, you know, I think when you work with students, and in my capacity as a counselor, I'm always looking to normalize their experiences, because when you normalize, you remove the shame. Mm-hmm. And when you remove the shame, you make it safe to ask for help. And that's what we want. We want to be teaching kids to be helpers and to be asking for help when they need assistance. And we want to be creating the same environment for teachers where it is okay to make mistakes, and it is okay to not know everything and to figure it out as you go along. And so I think that that same normalizing piece that you're talking about with the mastermind groups is really an extension of what we're doing with our students all of the time.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's great to end on. Out of all the things that we talked about today, what's one thing you'd like people to remember in particular?
You know, we're all in this for the same reason, which is to turn out good people. Mm-hmm. And in order to turn out good people, we have to be authentic, and we have to be ourselves, and we have to be willing to admit what we've done wrong and make it safe for them to make mistakes. But we also have to own what we're good at and what we can contribute, and to feel confident about our strengths. I think often our tendency is to veer in one direction or the other, to either feel like a complete failure or to feel like you're on top of the world and then suddenly something deflates you. And to just present a more realistic presentation of what it means to be human to students and to our colleagues is really the way to go through the world in the most mentally healthy, emotionally healthy way.
Yeah, no, I think that's great to point out to those educators who are listening. Where can people find you online?
I have a website, phyllisfagel.com. I'm probably most active, though, on Twitter. I tweet at pfagel. And my book is Middle School Matters, and I freelance for lots of different publications, but most often for the Washington Post. Most of my articles are on my website, though.
Well, thank you so much for being on the Out of the Trenches podcast. It was a pleasure talking to you today.
It was really nice talking to you, too, Dana. Thank you.